is Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell, awakening the world to the power of God's Word. And now here is your host, Dr. William Campbell.
Welcome to Beyond Words Radio, where it's our ambition to move beyond simply talking about Christianity to truly living it. And this is certainly a great challenge, especially as we live in an age in which the culture seems to be going the other direction. And it seems more difficult to come together in public worship in the institutional church. We have with us guest Josh Packard, who's a professor of sociology, and he has great interest in this whole idea of people struggling with the church, maybe people who, because they love God, are leaving the church. Does that sound crazy? It's happening all over the country. Josh is co-director of the Social Research Lab. He's author of numerous academic articles, reviews, and books. And the book I'm especially looking at with you, the listeners, now, with Josh's help, as he is a co-author with Ashley Hope. These two are sociologists. The book is titled Church Refugees. So hold on for the ride. Put on your thinking cap, because there might be some innovative thoughts here and challenges for all of us. Josh, thank you for writing this book and now for coming on the air.
Yeah, I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so Church Refugees. What got into your mind? Why did you write this book?
You know, it started off for us as a sort of what I thought was going to be a little project. You mentioned the co-author on the book. I was working here at the University of Northern Colorado and teaching sociology of religion, and Ashley came up to me after class one day and took me up on my offer. I tell students all the time that there's always research projects they can get involved with, and she said, "But you know, I'd like to do something." And I said, "Okay." And so I sort of keep a bunch of these, or you know, not a bunch, but a couple of these projects in my back pocket at all times that if students want to get some experience that they can plug into, and this was one of them. And I really thought it would just be a nice little project for an undergraduate student to sort of learn the ropes. And boy, I tell you, as we started getting into it, and word finally got around of what we were looking into, it was amazing. The response, it was so much bigger than I think we ever thought it was going to be. And once that happened, something switched for us. At some point along the way, we looked at each other and realized that this was going to have to be more than just, you know, a paper that lives in a scientific journal that we felt obligated to make sure that we were honoring the stories that we were hearing and the analysis that we were able to do and the sort of scientific insights that we were able to have and bring them out into the public where the rest of the world could engage them and, you know, do what they needed to do with them.
So, Josh, we're focusing now on those you label as duns. Did you come up with that phraseology?
So Ashley and I have not been, we can't take all the credit here. We mostly have just had enough good sense to nod our heads yes when people have come by with good ideas. And this is one of those situations where it makes more sense for us academically to refer to people who have left the church but kept their faith as the de-churched. Because it fits into, you know, academically we think of church as expanding. A church is a thing that exists across all religions. Because a church refers to a kind of organization for us. But obviously that's not the way that it's used in the real world. And so as we were trying to figure out how to make that concept ring true to people in the rest of the country, my editors and people at Group came up with this term duns to sort of play off the idea of nuns, because there was a lot of confusion at first. A lot of the people thought we were talking about, you know, folks who had turned their back on God and would just be another group of the nuns that we've been hearing so much about from Pew and other sources. Of course, that's not the case. The people we're talking to very much still identify, they still affiliate with, in this case, they still affiliate with Christianity. They're just done with church. And so it became a nice little way to make, it was an easy way to make that distinction between the nuns and duns.
Now, in case anyone is confused, it's possible. We're not talking about N-U-N, the Catholic nun. We're talking about those who have no affiliation with church. They have none.
Right. So when we asked that question on the survey, you know, when we put out surveys and we asked that question of, do you identify, you know, do you affiliate with a religion? And you can click yes or check yes or no. And then the follow-up question is always, if so, you know, Christian Protestant, Christian Catholic, Muslim, Jewish, Hindu, et cetera. And then the last box is always, but if you clicked none in that box of do you affiliate, then you have no affiliation. We call you a nun. That means you don't believe in God. You don't identify. That group has been in the news a lot. We don't need to, you know, we didn't want to contribute to that. That wasn't really our goal, because that's been well studied by sociologists, religious scholars, and other people. But this group, the group of people who were leaving the church but not their faith, that was a group that nobody really was paying attention to.
So I know Barna and also Kinnaman have, for example, come up. I think the statistic you list was 33% of those who just simply are not in the church. But you're saying this is a subcategory, the Duns. And what percentage would that be of our population? Do you know?
Yeah, so it's about, I'm going to pull up the exact number here, but if I remember correctly, it's about 15% of American adults, or about 30 million people.
About half of those who are not going to church then do love God, and they may even have left because they want to pursue God, not because they were running from God.
That's right. What was one of the overwhelming, you know, that was one of the overwhelming things that we found that I was not really prepared for. I thought that we would end up with a number of people who were sort of done with church and then done with the activity of church even, but that wasn't the case. They were overwhelmingly sort of leaving to do more stuff, not less stuff. As one of our respondents said, the church doesn't ask too much of people, it asks the wrong things of them, which I thought was such a great way of making that thing so clear, that they weren't burned out. You know, we went through all the literature about burnout, and these people were not burned out. They were absolutely still engaged with doing the work in many cases. Just they were doing what they would call, one person said, I want to do kingdom work, not church work.
Well, Josh, you're a sociologist, and before we get into all the nuts and bolts, the details that are so important for all of our listeners, first let's get the context. Here we have a culture that is becoming more engrossed in postmodernism, relativism, and whereas it used to be a positive thing to go to church, the culture generally pushed people into church, now it's seen as a negative. They're kind of being drawn away. Is this a factor, and what might other factors be that make it difficult for the church as we have known it for so many generations, the institutionalized church, to survive today?
Well, I think that the church is dealing with an issue that it didn't wholly create, but that it probably has to deal with at some point. And that happens to all kinds of industries, that you often have to respond to and deal with things that weren't necessarily of your doing. But if you're going to survive and thrive, then you've got to adapt. And I think that's what's happening in the church here as well. The argument that I make throughout the book, that I've been making over the last few months as I've been speaking with people since the book came out, is that we've got a country that is still overwhelmingly religious, and not just religious, but Christian. Those numbers may be declining somewhat, but the general trend over the last 50 years is one of still pretty steady beliefs. We have people expressing very high levels of belief in God and the importance of religion in their lives, saying that it remains as high now, or sometimes, in some cases, higher than it was in the 1950s even. People pray actually more now than they did, especially if you include meditation, which that gets a little bit tricky, but then it goes up, and we're talking somewhere, you know, in the 90% for some of these things.
So that's what you show, is that people are praying as much or more than ever. They're committed to God. They are religious, but they're not going. The numbers going attending institutional churches is going down.
Right. Like, that was the sort of contradiction that we were trying to grapple with, and it told us what that told us was that this wasn't necessarily a church thing, that this was sort of bigger than the church. And so we started looking around to see, well, what's happening with our other social institutions? And, you know, when you look around at the other major social institutions in society, they're not in terribly good shape either, at least when it comes to membership. Activity is a different thing, right? But when it comes to membership, they're also declining. So people are less likely to be engaged in local politics, for example. They don't trust their school leaders. They certainly don't trust Congress to do anything. More than ever, in light of the 2008 financial collapse, they don't trust business leaders. So we started looking into this research, and what we've got is a really steady, noticeable decline in trust and participation in civic structures since about the middle 1970s. And the church is part of that. Some places have figured out how to be a little bit more innovative in this space. I have every reason to believe that the church will be innovative in this space also, and we can talk about why I feel that way. But right now, the church is sort of dealing with a lack of institutional engagement across the board. Did the church have a role in creating that? Sure. I mean, certainly there were televangelists who were stealing people's money in the 1980s, and certainly, you know, there were Catholic priests who were, you know, committing all kinds of abuse, and those things did not help. But they didn't. They were not wholly responsible for the situation that exists currently. The other things that I've talked about, Richard Nixon and Watergate, was really where we start to see the decline of this sort of trust in our leaders. Those things matter too. And so you've got this society that we live in where people don't expect that their social institutions are going to be useful for them, let alone even trust them. And that's across the board.
That's the world we live in now. And so
Right. There
may be some who are listening who say, I'm one of those people. You know, I'm having a hard time going to church, but they're still hanging on.
Yeah.
And there are others who are truly done. They're outside the church, but they still love God. And there are many who are inside the church, and they're loving it. What do we do about this? I guess one alternative is to ignore the rest of the world. And if we do, would you say churches will just continue to decline?
Well, I don't really think that that's possible. So, like, I've been talking to a lot of pastors over the last 6 months, and one of the things that I say time and time again is that you may have, especially, you know, when I talk to pastors of churches who, you know, maybe mega churches, and they're growing and adding members like crazy, because that still happens. I say, like, you know, you don't have to care about this group of people. The group of people that are sitting in your congregations that are almost done, which we know there's about 7.5 million of those people in the country right now, the 30 million who've already left, if you don't want to care, you don't have to care. But what I know is that somebody's going to figure it out. And it's not that they're going to get them to come back necessarily for Sunday morning, sit in the pews and do the thing that they've always done by, you know, bringing in a shiny new band or something like that. That's not what the Duns want. Mm-hmm. But there will be some kind of religious innovation that pops up on the scene, or more than likely multiple kinds, that engages this group of people, that creates vibrant and thriving ministries that are sustainable. And I mean that, and absolutely in the buzzword, that it's sustainable both in terms of activity and financially. Mm-hmm. Somebody's going to come along and crack the nut, and they're going to do it because they really care about this group, and because this group of people still desires collective and community worship, and they value those things, mm-hmm. And being and doing together. Somebody's going to figure it out. It doesn't have to be every church, but somebody will.
So let's try to figure it out some together. We've got you on the air for a reason. We want to learn from you. You've been studying this and observing. You mentioned community a lot. Is that one of the keys? We need to learn how to build community that feels and truly is real. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. In the book, I go through what I call tensions. They're not paired opposite that tell us why the Duns have left. So, for example, they want community, but they encounter judgment. So judgment is not the opposite of community. Solitude is the opposite of community, right? Mm-hmm. But what our respondents kept telling us was that as an atmosphere of judgment from the other congregants. They're totally fine with God judging them. Some of them are totally cool with that. Some of them don't care. But that's a wholly separate issue, right? Mm-hmm. What they were talking about is that a spirit of judgment from within the congregation was detrimental to their ability to form true community. Because, like you said, that has always been a feature of social life, not just religious or Christian life. But people desire community. And if they can't mm-hmm. find it in their church, they're going to go find it somewhere else.
Yeah. Okay. So that's one thing we should focus on. Do you have suggestions? How can a church be very intentional about creating authentic community?
I sort of shy away a little bit from getting too prescriptive in that area because I think that there's a lot of stuff out there that is written specifically for a Christian context. It's actually pretty good. There are some general guidelines and principles that the Duns have told us that I think make a lot of sense. And one of them is this notion of, you know, how do you create a space where there's all the good things about community, all the important things about community, like accountability and like somebody being able to hold you to, you know, your word for the things that you say that you're going to do, mm-hmm. while also being supportive. One of the things that we found from the Duns is that they weren't interested in just sort of finding a place that was going to validate everything. You know, you probably have people like this in your life, actually, that they come to you after they've done something or as they're about to do something, and they're looking for validation that it's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. Sometimes as a friend, it's really hard to validate that thing because it's not a good choice, right?
Exactly.
And the Duns weren't looking for that. They really wanted to be engaged with the hard questions. But what is interesting, I think, is about the positioning of who has the ability to call you on the mat for something you've done or for a decision you're about to make. And this came through really clear to me when I was talking about this project, actually, with my father. My dad grew up Catholic, still is Catholic, and he was like, well, you know, people just do what their pastors tell them to do, right? And I said, well, no, you would be surprised, Dad. They don't. And so we started talking about it, and he said, when I was a kid, you know, I would have done anything that anybody with the collar, you know, if they said show up on Sunday morning, I would show up on Sunday morning. If they said show up on Wednesday evenings, I'd show up. And I said, well, would you do that now? And he said, no, actually, I don't guess that I would. And so I think even you can see just in his lifetime that that has changed. And as we dug even further into that, we started talking about, you know, who could actually get you to do something just because they asked. And he started listing off people, and it was, you know, his wife, me, and, you know, a couple of other close friends. And so what that sort of crystallized in my brain was a lot of things that I've been hearing from the Duns, which is that authority still matters, right? The nature of authority is still the same. Mm-hmm. Everybody, like, you know, you can't really have community without accountability and all those good things. But what has changed is the locus of authority. We live in an era, I don't think this is about generation, I really don't, because I think my dad's in the same boat that I'm in, that some of my younger millennial respondents were in, which is that they don't trust people just because of the position that they hold. Just because a pastor says it from the pulpit doesn't mean they're going to do it. Instead, the people that they trust are the ones that they have relationships with. If you're trying to figure out what resource to use or how to create community in your congregation, I think you have to start there. It has to start with relationship. I don't know how your life works, but when I pitch this, you know, scenario to people, and I say, who could get you to make real change in your life? Name the person. Very few people name their pastors. It's always the people that are closest to them that have those deep day-to-day relationships with.
That's a shift that's happened through a few generations in our country. And
I think so, yeah.
And we need to recognize the importance. And I appreciate how you emphasize for a healthy church, the focus should not be on a person, but on the people, on the community. You go on in Chapter 3 to bring the next area of tension, activity and bureaucracy. How is it that our bureaucracy is maybe inhibiting people from being active in churches?
Have you ever heard this language of come to our church and get plugged in?
Mm-hmm.
That made a lot of sense to me. I grew up in the church. I go to church now. I've used that language. And what our respondents said was what that really communicated to them was implicitly that there's something wrong with you that you can't fix without us. We know what's going on, so come here and do this thing that we've already figured out. So as opposed to engaging people, you know, where they're at in their life and maybe recognizing the gifts and talents and things that people are already doing that are really of value. Instead, what they were finding was that it was really working from this deficit model of come here and do whatever it is that we ask you to do because implicitly we know what's going on. People in our group really expressed that when they wanted to do meaningful activity, they just would run into these layers and layers and layers of bureaucracy.
So I guess we could, again, looking at the broad cultural side, say that the generation we now call the builders, they kind of like the structure, but you get to the boomers, down to the millennials, the Gen X and Y.
Sure.
Less and less is there an appreciation for church as being just, I've got a position, but much more, I'm part of a family. There are people here in my life. And so you're saying people are less satisfied with being given a job. They want something more.
Yeah, I think that there's a real desire for both. So I don't think there's another institution in the country that does a better job than the church in terms of building people up and giving them opportunities who walk in the door with no skills or training at all. You know, nobody's walking into the door of Google who isn't an engineer and saying, I'd like a job and I'd like for you to train me in how to be a software engineer. Google's not doing that, right? But the church will. And I think it's amazing how much time and energy clergy and lay leaders are willing to pour into other people to build them up. Once they're built up, then they're often sort of stifled if they have new and good ideas. And I think that, like, the way that church is structured to be so much inside the walls and so much according to that structure is sort of at odds, actually, with the central message, at least for a lot of Protestant Christianity for the last 30 or 40 years. Like, I don't think you can run around the country and tell people, as the church has been doing largely, the evangelical church especially for decades, and say, you should have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ and that you should, you know, you should really work on developing your individual calling and figuring out what God wants for you. And at the same time, then when people actually want to exercise that calling, telling them, yeah, it's not the way we do things here. Go through those three committees and submit those reports, and then we'll send it to church council, and then we'll talk about it, and then we'll let you know. it's a recipe for failure. Because you're building up all these people with this idea that somehow God is calling them, and that may very well be the case. But then you can't turn around and stifle that call, which I think our structures do. I don't think people are trying to. I just think that we have a lack of good structures.
Mm. In chapter 4, then you go to another area of attention, conversation and doctrine. Tell us what that's about.
Well, I think this is where we get into a little bit of this idea of authority here, too, that a lot of pastors will hear this last chapter and this chapter about conversation and doctrine, and they'll think that, people don't want doctrine, they don't want dogma, it's because they want to be validated all the time, they want to be able to believe whatever it is that they want to believe and have me say that it's okay and I'm not going to do that. When people respond that way, I say, just read the book. Or, you know what, if you read that chapter, I'll send you that chapter. That's not the case. Our respondents were much more along the lines of saying things like, God is bigger than any one person, which I think we could all agree on. So how could I possibly understand God by just listening to one person? Mm. I think we live in an era when people expect to be able to talk about things, not because they are narcissistic or they like to hear themselves talk. I think it's the way we have taught people how to learn and engage with any kind of material.
So in essence, around bureaucracy, you're saying, if you want community, here's how to do it, the way you run the church. And around doctrine and conversation, you're saying, you want community, here's not how to do, but how to teach it. We've got to be interactive. And it's all going back to community, isn't it? So the next chapter, and this is sort of the final one, and we'll get really into the meat of it, but meaningful ministry versus moral prescription. People, I guess, don't want to be told, here's what to do. They want to be led in a path of the doing.
Yeah, we put this chapter last of the sort of tension chapters because this is where we get into what I think most people would jump to initially, which is that there's a whole bunch of people leaving the church for social issues. Mm. That is both true and not true, right? So it's true in the sense that social issues can be at the heart of why people leave, but it's not true for the reasons that people think. Our respondents weren't so concerned about, a particular church's teaching on same-sex marriage or women in ministry. If they were concerned about that, that's actually a reason why people switch churches. We have lots and lots and lots of research about why people switch churches. And social issues are absolutely a reason why people switch churches. Most people have enough options available to them as the country is increasingly urbanized and dense that they can switch to a congregation. If they want a congregation that's open and affirming, many people can find them. Not everybody, but many. We're seeing that now, and advocates as well for LGBTQ populations. We're seeing the Mormon Church deal with that now, with lots of switching and resignations that go on. What our respondents were most concerned about was that this very narrow version of biblical morality was obscuring and getting in the way of all of the wide path things that our respondents both thought was more important and had more agreement around. So I think the opening to that chapter, the quote is, drugs and sex, drugs and sex, drugs and sex. I wanted to feed the poor and the church just wanted to police me. It was always drugs and sex. Hmm. And that really becomes the gateway into this larger conversation. My respondent's attitude wasn't that drugs and sex don't matter. It was that there's all these other things that do also matter, maybe more, and that we can even agree on certainly more, and that our focus on drugs and sex really is getting in the way of being able to do the work that we can actually all agree on. I think one of our other respondents said, why does homosexuality have to be the thing that we deal with first? Why can't we get everything else in the New Testament right and then deal with homosexuality?
For example, why aren't we out in the streets caring for the poor?
That's right.
Yeah. So working for justice and equality, showing love to our neighbors, hitting some of the big cultural issues that we can touch.
That's exactly right.
Often the areas of sexuality, they're very relevant. We want our people to live in holiness, but if that's the only thing we're talking about, how relevant will we become to a society that has many other deeper felt needs? Okay, so a time for one last question for this first half, Josh. If you had one word of encouragement for a pastor, a person in the church who's listening, and you want to encourage them to say, this can be turned around in your church, you can do a better job, what would you tell them?
Well, I would say, first of all, that the duns are probably a relatively small part of, or the near duns that are currently in your congregation, the duns who have recently left, are a relatively small part of your congregation. At no point do I suggest in the book or elsewhere that you should completely turn over your organization in pursuit of the duns, because your church is probably working for 80-85% of the people who are attending. Everything that we suggest is things that an existing congregation can do around the edges to make their organization more dynamic, more open, more fluid. It's going to be a little bit messier you're going to have to trust a little bit more in the Holy Spirit. You know, you're going to have to believe that God is leading you to do a particular kind of thing. But it doesn't require you to stop doing all the things you're doing and do a wholly different set of things. There are just some techniques that we talk about that I think, you know, many congregations who care about this group of people would do well to sort of implement or think about. And if, you know, if you remember the sort of church, the larger idea of church, or denomination, or even church outside of denominational bounds, then I think the encouragement here is that, and we can maybe talk about this a little bit more in the second half, but the church in America has always been about innovation, and somebody will innovate. Maybe that's your calling. Maybe that's what you're going to do. But somebody, like I said earlier, somebody will come along and figure it out.
Yeah. So what other points, Josh, you know best, having done this research and talked to a lot of people in churches and pastors, what are some other final points you might want to give us to really help someone deal with the world we're in now and to make the institutional church also more of a community, a more effective ministry model for all kinds of people?
There's this real issue between sort of training and trust. You know, we get trained in, especially with our professional church leaders, but also with our lay leaders, in how to do things the right way. And I think that part of the call for what the church is going to have to be if it's going to reach this group of people and keep the near-dones is there's going to have to be a lot more trust in God and a lot more trust in the Holy Spirit to be able to pick up the pieces that maybe fall apart sometimes. Because like I said, it's, you know, part of it is going to be messier. Now, you know, you want to be really careful about the things that you're doing with your organization because you don't want chaos to run throughout your entire church. Nobody, you know, I don't think any of the things that we argue for in the book, you know, would lead to that. We are giving a very sort of like, do this, but here's the limits to what you should be doing here because you don't want this to overtake everything that you do. But there is going to be a certain amount of trust. I mean, you know, if you're really pursuing community, if you're really letting people be engaged, are they going to say things that you disagree with? Yeah, they're going to. Are they going to go places as a representative of your congregation? And is somebody going to do or say something that you wish that they hadn't said or done? Absolutely. But I feel like that's, you know, at least if you're talking to the Duns, that's a risk that I think that you're going to have to take. Somebody pointed this out to us that the Duns, because they're willing to work with anybody and because they're so driven by these sort of issues as opposed to the sort of doctrine, they're the biggest bridge that the church has to the nuns, the people who have no affiliation. And then they followed that observation up by saying, and if that's the case, what do we think that the Duns are saying about your church? But like, oh my goodness, like I had not actually put all those thoughts together, but they all made sense to me. And I thought, like, that is definitely something that I think needs to be considered. The church seems to have gotten this pattern, this fundamental pattern backwards, which is that they sort of think that if we can just get everybody to believe correctly, then they will belong together. And in sociology, we know that's not true. Belonging comes first and believing follows. If you want people to ultimately form a community, then you've got to get them where they have shared beliefs and common values. You have to get them to where they can belong together. And the church spends a lot more time right now focusing on believing than belonging.
That's a very good summary, I think, of this whole topic of church refugees, how to bring them back home. Well, let's give them a place to belong. Let's give them a home. Well, Josh, I thank you. You've given us a lot to think about. And I thank you and Ashley for your research for this book. And I thank the listeners for being with us in this journey and encourage you to continue on it by reading the book, Church Refugees. Thank you, Josh.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity. It's been a great conversation.
This has been Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell. Beyond Words is a ministry of Scripture Awakening. And if you'd like to help support this ministry, or if you would like to know more about Beyond Words, visit us on our website at scriptureawakening.com.